Find a pen and fill the paper with the message that it wants to send.
Hello and welcome to the Aviatrix Book Review Writer's Room. I'm Liz Booker. I am continuing my conversation with Keith O'Brien. He's published three books, Fly Girls, the topic of today's discussion, which also comes in a young reader's version for ages 10 and up, Outside Shot, Big Dreams, Hard Times, and One County's Quest for Basketball Greatness, and Paradise Falls, the true story of an environmental catastrophe. So Keith, you were a journalist, a very successful journalist, and you had apparently a very long career in writing. Tell me about your journey.
Well, sure. So I started as a newspaper reporter and moved my way up from small newspapers to larger ones. And, my last couple stops were at the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the Boston Globe, and I spent several years there. I love newspapers, and I loved my job. I felt like the reason why I got involved as a writer, a newspaper writer and a reporter in the first place was just the opportunity to see the world from other people's perspectives and to be in places where I shouldn't be able to be and to ask folks anything and then tell those stories. I thought that was just truly amazing. So that's why I got into it in the first place. And, but I wanted to tell longer stories. And, it just felt like I wasn't getting that opportunity. And so I started branching out into books about 12 years ago. And, I've been very fortunate to have had some success there as well.
That is incredible. So what did you do, in that transition to enhance your craft or prepare to do that kind of new writing?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's new and it's not new. When you're a writer, you need to be reading. If you want to be a writer, you need to read. And so, from my, college days forward, I was always the kind of person who was reading a book with a pen or a highlighter and tabbing pages and bending pages over and writing notes in the margins, even when it wasn't for school. I as a writer, I'm always trying to decode what someone else has done. If you spend enough time analyzing someone's narrative structure, you can sort of see how they've done it. And so I think in that way, I had been preparing really all my life. But it is different. There's a different cadence and rhythm and pacing to a 100,000-word story than a 1,000-word story. Early on, I didn't even really know how long a book was. I remember when I sold my first book, Outside Shot, I sold it to the publisher, and it was very exciting. And my agent called me and said, you got a book deal. And he said, they wanted to, in January or whatever it was. And he said, you think you can do that? And I said, I guess, like, how many words are we talking about here? And he said, oh, roughly like 100,000. And I didn't even really know that a book was 100,000. And I remember getting off the phone that night. It was late in the day. And like, it should have been this celebratory moment. And I remember turning to my wife and I said, how am I going to write 100,000 words by January? That seems impossible. And, now I know, of course, it's not impossible. And in fact, the hardest thing to do is to cut words. For example, I mentioned, I'm writing a book right now about the rise and the fall of Pete Rose. And so this is the full arc, right? This is going to bring him to the mountaintop and then watch what happens after that. And, the challenge is to tell that story with no extraneous words and keep the flow going and do it in a way that's powerful and well-written but not too long. And so, you know, what I'm always doing is going back at the end of writing a chapter and seeing like, can I cut 1,000 words? Can I cut 500 words? Does this paragraph need to be here? Could you just move on? Keep it tight. And so the challenge now for me is not, can I write 100,000 words, but can you write, you know, 100,000 good words and keep it that short?
Yeah. And you, with your research, both for Fly Girls and it sounds like the book that you're working on now, and I'm sure Paradise Falls, I'm curious how you keep all of that material straight. Like from a technical standpoint, how do you organize your research and keep track of it as you're building it to write your narrative?
I wish I could sit here and tell you, Liz, that I'm incredibly well organized and I have everything in nice, neat little piles, but I do not. You know, most of the documents that I have, both for Fly Girls and Paradise Falls and for the Pete Rose book I'm working on now, are digital. You know, I've scanned them or photocopied them. And so they live, you know, on a desktop and on a backup drive. And so you're always moving things around into different folders thematically by year or chronology or topic. But a lot of times it really is just about remembering the nugget and where it is. And, you know, I know a lot of writers have, big writers have teams of assistants who are doing some of this material, organizing for them. But for me, I need to read that story that existed in Aviation Magazine from 1937. So I remember, oh yeah, that's the story. That's the story that has the detail about Amelia's helmet, you know? And so that way I remember it. I know, okay, when I get to that part in the story, I got to go back to that article and pop that lovely, beautiful detail in. And so for me, it's about, you know, organizing on a desktop, putting things in folders, thematically and chronologically, but also just reading them along the way. So I remember, you know, where that certain detail is.
Well, another thing that I loved about this book was the, I talked about back matter earlier, but your notes and the index. And so for anybody who is looking to dig deeper into one of these characters' stories, you have the start of your research here all laid out for you. So I think that's fabulous. And I just was like, oh my word, you know, I've written research papers, but nothing that, you know, would include that kind of citation. So I thought it was fabulous.
Well, thank you.
And I aspire, I mean, I'm writing fiction right now. I've written some articles, but it's the more that I talk to writers like you and Lauren Kessler, who also, she wrote the book about Pancho Barnes. I just am fascinated by this historical narrative nonfiction. So hopefully some subject will just grab me and I'll go for it someday. You know, for this, speaking of Lauren Kessler, one of the things that she talked about in my interview with her was this immersive journalism that she has used to write several of her books, which is what it sounds like you did with this basketball team. So for authors who are thinking about doing that kind of work, tell us about that experience.
Right. So for my book Outside Shot, I had full access to a team, to a school. You know, I was in the classroom, on the bus, in the locker room, in their homes. It's a different challenge than, say, a book like Fly Girls, you know, where you're not immersing yourself physically in a place. You're digging up material. You know, and each have its own challenges. With a book like Fly Girls, you're trying to find the material. It is that detective hunt to find those telegrams and letters and diaries and flight logs and notebooks. With an immersive journalism project, you have to keep your eyes and your ears open. You have to make sure you're at the meeting, you're at the place. If the thing is going to happen, you got to be there for it, and you got to sort of know what you're looking for, because you know, I have found, and I imagine a lot of other writers have found, that, you know, when you're doing a project like that, and you spend, say, 10 hours in a place, there might be only a couple moments at the end of that day that actually really matter to the narrative you're telling. And so you have to be there for them and maintain your access, you know, which is a challenge sometimes to make sure you can keep coming back every day.
Well, I'm sure it involves building a lot of trust with people.
It does. It does involve building a lot of trust. And for me, you know, I just try to be very transparent with anybody, whether I'm, you know, interviewing them for a book or spending time with them immersively for a book. Just be very transparent about what you're doing and what you're looking for, or, you know, why you're asking a certain question. You know, if someone says, well, why are you asking me that? Tell them, you know, I feel like if you're transparent and honest about what you're trying to do, people will be more open to talking to you about it. And for me, I don't think there's any other way to do it. I want to be transparent and honest about the project I'm working on.
You seem to be, well, I mean, you've had years of practice at this, but you're still relatively new to writing book-length works. You seem to be a fast writer, just churning stuff out every couple of years. I mean, you said you learned about this story, or your interest was piqued in 2016, and this came out, what, 2018? And, you know, I did mention earlier, and I'll ask this question in a minute, but related to that, I'm curious to know what your author life is like. What's your writer life like? How do you manage your time?
So I work from home right here in New Hampshire. I'm a father of two boys and a spouse of a working mother. So our life is crazy. And I would love to be able to be at my desk every morning at 7 a.m. and writing all day. That rarely happens. In an ideal situation, the kids go off to school and I'm at my desk and I'm writing until they get home. Once they do get home, things typically get pretty busy around here. And I need to take a few hours off to get them off to where they need to go in the evening, or to, you know, get dinner on the table, or, you know, the normal rhythms of family life. And, you know, I often do go back to work, though, in the evenings, after 9 o'clock for a couple of hours to get to a place that I feel good about. When I am in writing mode, I do want to know how many words I've written in a given day. It's not really about words in a given day, but I want to know what kind of progress I made. Was it 600 words? Was it 1,200 words? Was it less? That is a good barometer. But every day, the next morning, I will start by rereading what I wrote the previous day, in part to make sure I was on the right path, and in part to remind myself of where I am on that path, and then I'll begin again.
That's great. You know, I transitioned from a very sort of immediate instant gratification world of being a search and rescue pilot and managing those kinds of operations where I could see the results right in front of me immediately and feel like I did something that day. Transitioning to writing full time, I had to come up with all of these tricks of sometimes there's this great app called, I think it's called the Tree app, but it's a Pomodoro method. So I can set it for my writing time. And then at the end of the day, I have all these trees that I grew that show that I did some work, because my work it's abstract, locked away in the computer the way it is. You can't see it like you can see a physical book. So I appreciate that you, who've been writing as long as you have, still have to have sort of that mental reward.
You do. You need something, because it, as you know, it's a it can be a lonely existence. It depends on where you are in your project, but oftentimes no one's looking over your shoulder. No one's holding you accountable. You know, you have to hold yourself accountable. And, for me, I think the few guiding principles are, that the words aren't going to write themselves. You can talk about your book all day, but the words aren't writing themselves. You're going to have to get in there and do the time. And then the second thing I just try to remind myself is just get it all on paper, get it all down, and you can always go back and fix it, get it on paper and then revise, cut, revise, change. You can remold lots of things once you have something in the works. But until you do, it is completely abstract.
Oh, it's an exact quote that Kate Quinn gave me a couple months ago. She was quoting somebody else, but that you, I can fix a bad page, but I can't fix a blank page.
Like it. Yes, true.
Sums up everything that you just said.
Yes.
So, I wanted to mention, and I did in the introduction for the first part of our interview, that there is a young reader's version of your book. I'd like to know how that came about.
For starters, I have to give credit to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which was the publisher of Fly Girls. From the moment they bought the book on proposal, they said, this is going to be a book, and then we're going to do a young reader's edition. And so that was in the plans from the very beginning, and is a credit to them. And I personally was the one who adapted the book and essentially trimmed it down. So
I was wondering,
Fly Girls is about 100,000 words, roughly, give or take. I think it's a little longer. And the Fly Girls Young Readers Edition is roughly half of that. And so really, it is just a slightly abridged version of the story. And is a perfect book for, any young reader, depending on their reading level, between the ages of, 8 and 12, 8 and 13. And it's been really such a great thing. I've had the opportunity to be in a number of schools and talk with kids about this story. I know of schools that have assigned the book to kids. I've done interviews with kids who have read the book and are writing about it for a book report, and many other special moments like that. A couple years ago, before the pandemic, in the spring of 2019, a mother in Massachusetts reached out to me, and she said that her daughter, who was in middle school, was doing a wax museum project. This is a project that exists in many middle schools, fourth grades, fifth grade, sixth grades, where, a student dresses up like someone famous and then writes.
My son was Orville Wright last year.
Well,
I'm familiar.
Well, I don't know how it happened at your school, but at most of these schools, including my kids' own school, they usually sort of give the kids a list. Like, it's like, oh, if you like football, you could be one of these people. If you like aviation, you could be Amelia Earhart, right?
It's right, always, right.
For girls, it's always, if you like aviation, you could be Amelia Earhart. And this particular girl in Massachusetts had read my book, and she said, I don't want to be Amelia Earhart. I want to be Ruth Nichols. And so the mother reached out to me to say, do you have any documents or photographs you can share with us for her little storyboard? And so, of course, I emailed her a little Dropbox with a few things that she might be able to use for her project. And then I just asked, because I live in New Hampshire, I'm not that far away. I said, when's the wax museum? And she told me, and it just so happened that on the very day of the wax museum, I was due to speak at a college in Massachusetts, right in the very same town. And so I said, well, this is crazy. I'm going to actually come And so, you know, I did actually go to the Wax Museum, which was amazing.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
it was awesome. Just another indicator of just how generous you are. That's fabulous. Well, as a writer, so my MFA is for writing for children and young adults. And so that's my focus. I'm writing stories about girls who learn to fly, are introduced into aviation and learn to fly. And as literary aviatrix promoting these books, I go to in-person events with a table full of books, and I sit down with the I've done Girl Scout events and other women in aviation events for young people. And I always bring a stack of books, and yours is always in it. So,
that's very nice.
And I continue to grow that because I'm going to make a list for librarians and stuff like that. So it will be on there.
That's incredible.
So I'm super glad that that happened, and impressed that you were able to cut it even more to get it to that length. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was like the opposite of writing. It was like, instead of, it was like going to the office every day and cutting off a limb is what it felt like. Hacking off the things that I love.
Yeah, that's painful. Well, before, I'm not plugged in, so we're going to have to wrap this up soon. I want to know what advice you have for writers, resources. I mean, you've already given us solid advice about just sit down and write, which is what most writers say. But are there any other resources or anything else that you want to share with aspiring writers?
You know, I would just say that to me, the most important thing is reading other people's work. Going to college and going to high schools and getting MFAs and working with mentors is a fantastic thing and an incredible opportunity if it exists. But as you and I both know, it isn't always possible for lots of reasons. Resources, money, your stage in life, the job you're already working, the children you have, those kind of things. And I guess what I believe in my core is that, you know, you can still do, you know, the work that you want to do without that. If you spend the time with the books that are already out there, because this isn't a secret formula. This isn't some kind of hidden thing. If you read other people's work, you can start to decode how they did it, and then you as a writer can say, okay, well, I remember these authors handling this situation this way, and I'm going to end my chapter like this because it's similar to how they did it, or whatever, which is how art builds upon itself.
Yeah. Keith, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights and for your books. They are wonderful.
Well, thank you, Liz. It was really such a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate your interest and your time. To save for later, you cannot trust it to come again. To wait for you to find a pen and fill the paper with the message that it wants.